Hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week our focus is fixed on the novel coronavirus as volatility emerges across global markets. Confirmed cases have surged now to over 81,000 cases worldwide and has so far claimed over 2,700 lives and appeared in 48 countries that we know of. Markets have eventually reacted with sustained falls over the last week, triggering calls of potential recessions, severe supply disruptions, and potential official global pandemic. Here to discuss how markets have now awoken in fright to the spectre of the coronavirus is our own chief strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. G'day, David.
G'day, Tim.
And our head of investments, Damien Klassen. Hello, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And just a quick reminder that before we get started, to subscribe on YouTube and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch. And follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And for those, of course, listening in live today, feel free to drop in your questions in the chat box below along the way. So let's jump into it. So our agenda today, stats so far. We're then going to be looking just lightly at some SARS comparisons. We'll then roll into some economic trade-offs. And we'll then be looking locally into the Australian impact on both tourism, students, commodity, the Reserve Bank of Australia and the Australian dollar. And finally, as always, we will be wrapping up with the investment implications, what we're doing in the portfolios in reaction to and to looking forward into these themes that we're discussing today across the bonds and commodities as well. So with no further ado, we'll roll into stats so far. Who to believe, gentlemen?
Yeah, I've got a chart up here, a couple of charts just sort of showing the Chinese cases. I just want to highlight that China's changed its definition on multiple occasions. We've sort of put on these graphs, we've shown three of them. There's actually been other ones as well that they've changed. But I think the biggest change was one back in on the 7th of February when they decided that anything that was, if you had the disease but it was only relatively mild, you wouldn't get counted as a case. Mm-hmm. And so that obviously affects these numbers quite significantly. We've got these charts where we've shown what it would mean if you just sort of extrapolated the number of cases, which we're assuming will be relatively severe cases, and then said, well, what would that actually mean for the actual case count? Mm-hmm. And we've also shown some of the suspected cases and just showing that those numbers are much higher, a factor of, you know, I don't know, 5-6 times higher at least. We're not entirely certain. Well, actually, we're pretty certain the numbers that are being reported aren't high enough as well. Mm-hmm. With all the different changes that are going on, some of them probably genuine, but there is a lot of, from day to day, there's a lot of, numbers from yesterday, we've misreported, we've changed these ones, and they're back and forth, and it's almost as if you're playing a bit of a game of just keep shuffling the numbers around and hoping that people will give up on trying to follow it and just accept whatever you tell them. Wow. is the right number.
Epoch Times had some leaked documents from Shenyang, I think, this morning.
Oh, right, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, on actual, from the local CDC, tabulating the actual numbers versus the announced numbers.
Right.
And they were somewhere between 25 and 50 times higher than reported.
Right.
They're reporting 2 or 3, and the real numbers were 50 and 100.
Right.
Wow.
And I know there's a couple of mathematicians out there who have done some quite good analysis of the numbers and just saying about how the numbers reported from China are on a quadratic function, whereas every other disease we've ever seen has been on a logarithmic, and this disease elsewhere. Yep. And so it's sort of just saying that the numbers are being massaged to fit a story as opposed to... But anyway, the numbers are there, and they're certainly... So I guess that's the big reason why we've always said you need to look at these numbers in three parts. One is the Hubei numbers, the second is the rest of China, and the third is the rest of the world.
Yep.
That's where you actually get a feel for what's going on, just knowing the numbers from China are just... that are tough to believe, but there's some sort of information in it. We're not quite sure exactly what that is.
Yep.
But so let's jump to the...
We will. And just for those that are listening in, we're going to be referring a lot to your fantastic compilation of charts that you've put together, and we've got that available, and we'll put a link in the show notes along with the chart pack today. Yeah. And it has actually gained a bit of acclaim, your research that you've been doing in charts around the world, as it seems.
So, yeah. So, I mean, we've just put them up live because we figured we may as well share what we're doing. we update the numbers all the time because we're paying close attention to what's been going on, and we've been doing it for weeks now.
Yep.
Because we do think this is critical to really working out what's going on in the rest of the world. And so, yeah, we've just put those charts up live on our site, and at nucleuswealth.com you can go and find that.
Or you can just Google them. It's Google them. Top 10 searches for COVID statistics at the moment globally. So, done, Damien.
So outside of China... So what we're doing here, and just to note that what we've done is said, okay, well, let's look at not just have you got the disease outside of China, but did you catch it outside of China? Because at the start, what we had was a lot of people who were, most of the cases you got elsewhere were people who just traveled from China to somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we did is strip that out so within the data and actually said, well, who are the people who actually caught it within a country? Because that's what we're really trying to find out is, and that's something we're sort of seeing very much in the data now is this huge outbreak right across the Middle East, which isn't actually really an outbreak in these countries yet. I think Bahrain might have 30 cases, maybe something like that. But it's not really an outbreak in Bahrain. This is just all people who have come from Iran.
Mm.
And so until we see actual cases within that country transferred and picked up naturally, that's where we start to get more concerned. And it's actually not even the first layer that's as concerning. It's more the second and third order effects, because if somebody comes from Iran to Bahrain and then infects somebody, you know, gets off the plane and shakes somebody's hand or pushes a luggage cart and infects somebody straight away there,
yep,
that's sort of that's more understandable, and you can sort of see that isn't really a reflection of is it transferring within the country, than if that person who then has the disease goes elsewhere and then passes it on to his family or something like that. That's, yep, more of an issue than a direct step. And so what we're seeing within that is these cases are doubling basically every 4 to 5 days. And that's been pretty consistent since we started. You know, we've seen that you go back 3 weeks ago, it was doubling every 5 days or less. You go back 2 weeks, it was doubling every 5 days. You go back 1 week, it was doubling every 5 days. Right now, it's doubling every 4 days.
Yep.
So until we actually start seeing that slow down, we've got to going to keep going.
Yep.
And one of the things we have been, on this graph on the left-hand one, you can see this big amount blowing out of these under investigation, where we know it doesn't come from China, but they're actually so busy they haven't actually even worked out where it's from. This is generally South Korea and Italy reporting these stats.
Yep.
Is that they just haven't had time. They're getting hundreds of cases, and they just don't have the time to do the forensic. Where did you get it from? You know, tracking it through that you, yep, see from places like Singapore, which have been really on top of this in terms of they're looking for, they get a detailed case history for everyone who's got it, of anyone who's been within 2 meters of that person for a prolonged period of time.
Yep.
So they're really trying to get on top of what's happening. The problem is once this gets too big, you can't do it. You just don't have the resources to actually track back through these cases.
And that sort of touches on an important point where, you know, confirmed cases means reliable testing means some form of testing. So, yes, you know, if you're not testing, then you can't confirm a case. So.
Well, exactly. And the test rates, I mean, they do have false positives, false negatives.
Yep.
So, which has been a bit of a problem because there's people have been tested and told, no, you haven't got it, and then gone and come back a few days later going, look, I still feel a bit sick. And then they've tested again and gone, oh, I actually do have it.
Wow.
Yep. And so there's places like Singapore where it's mandatory before they knock them away that they've tested them twice on separate things, because it might just be the person who's doing the test hasn't quite, you know, got the right section or done whatever.
Yep.
And so I guess what I'm saying is there's the level we get from different countries is very different, and places like Iran where there's just been this huge explosion of cases, not even just within Iran, just all the countries around it,
yep,
have all got it. And so you know the cases in Iran are way bigger than the 100 or so that they're talking about.
Absolutely.
Yep. I mean, their own health minister has it. Yeah, it's that part where...
Yeah, and it's an interesting one.
But at one stage they had 60. They had when he got it, they had 60 cases. They were telling everyone we had 60 cases. About 10 of them were already dead.
Yeah.
One of them was the actual health minister.
Yep.
And all these other countries around had all these cases coming through as well. So you know it's wrong, and you know there's, Iran. There is almost definitely an outbreak, at least of the size of South Korea, most probably moving towards China size.
It's an interesting outbreak. One too, actually. So my mother-in-law's Iranian, right? Yeah. And a microbiologist, or ex-microbiologist trained. And I was speaking to her last night about what's going on in Iran, and just to sort of say, well, have you got any inside intel, essentially? Mm. Where do you think it came from? So the city where it's sort of the center point is Qom.
Yep.
And actually is a renowned religious university hub for the Middle East. and they suspect that there was Chinese people coming in to go to uni at Quam. That may be the reason why, you know, that's the linking point potentially for that. So that bodes a little bit. That's an interesting case study now for perhaps you know, thoughts for turning back in local shores.
But it's obviously been sitting there for weeks. Like it's not like people don't die of this straight away.
That's right.
Usually takes at least 2 or 3 weeks before you get to the stage where people are dying.
Mm.
And so the fact you're getting, you know, more than a dozen dead there already means it's been there for a long time, and that means it's probably spread out in far more cases, far more places than you can possibly track down.
Yeah, and you've got, you know, lower levels of testing as well potentially, and it's caught them up. So, all right.
Yep. So the next one is just sort of going through this world, not an afterthought. So we've got the rest of China, just sort of comparing and contrasting statistics. So the rest of China data, which we don't really trust, but you know, anyway, it is what it is. Sort of showing this huge jump and then down. Like they had 5 cases yesterday. Across the whole of China, whereas the rest of the world's now into the pretty close to 500 cases yesterday. So there's certainly a very different when we get to see more data, it seems that the more we look at other data, the less the Chinese data seems to make sense in terms of that. And as well, we'll move on as well to how we think about some of these things going forward. Mortality rates. So there's a little bit of misinformation out there on mortality rates. We just wanted to highlight what we've tended to show. So the first thing is looking at the number of cases from today versus the number of deaths today is not accurate, because the problem is somebody who gets tested today hasn't had a chance to die yet. They may well die. You've got them as a case and they'll die over the next week or two, but you're still counting them as if they haven't died. So you actually have to do this lag and look back.
Mm.
And when we do that across a whole bunch of different places, it looks as if the death rate, once it gets out of control, is probably around 5%, maybe higher in places where your hospitals get overrun or you haven't got the same level of medical care. If you do have high levels of medical care and your hospitals aren't overrun, then you're probably below 1%. Could be as low as 0.5%, but you know, it depends upon different regions, and that's a big difference. You know, you're looking about 10 times the number of potentially 10 times the number of deaths, and so that's one of the key things to this. And we'll move on to that a little bit later. But one of the key things to this whole thing is making sure your hospitals don't get overrun, and because if your doctors are getting sick and your nurses are getting sick and people are turning up and you don't have enough ventilators and you don't have the processes, that's where this thing gets out of control.
Yep.
As we've seen in Hubei. And
I guess the scary thing with that as well is in Western countries, if you go down the road to get medical care in the hospitals for, what are you going to do? Just keep driving. You're going to end up at another hospital, aren't you?
Yeah.
Whereas in China, they could just sort of ring fence an entire city.
Well,
in the Western world, you'd suggest that people are just going to keep finding.
They can. In Italy now, there are armed guards at checkpoints these, and there is a 3-month prison sentence for skipping through one of these checkpoints.
Wow.
So Italy's actually got stricter quarantine on it than what China has. In China, they've, in some of these towns they've put on, like in China they can leave once a day or once every couple of days. They're allowed to go out and sort of buy some groceries or do whatever and come back one at a time and keeping distance away from other people. But in Italy, it's a stricter lockdown with bigger jail sentences. So I guess what I'm saying is people say, oh no, China's the only place that can do this. They're not. Other places can and will do it and probably should do it in terms of it sounds bad and it's a restriction of my personal rights and all this type of stuff like that, but people's rights don't extend to spreading viruses to other people, and so governments will crack down and probably be supported for it, I think, in most countries.
Great point. Moving on.
Yep. Okay. One of the charts I didn't put up, I forgot to put this one in, was just the summer versus winter as well. So that's one where, which I haven't, you can find that on the website, but we're just looking at countries where there has been submission in and you're currently in summer or you're an equatorial country versus winter. And there is a huge difference between the two. So it does look as if there's quite strong correlation between the two.
Yep.
We look at somewhere like, I don't completely trust the Vietnamese numbers, but all the cases we've seen in Vietnam have been in the north of Vietnam where they do have a summer versus winter.
Yep.
The south of Vietnam where it's very temperate right throughout the time period, they haven't.
Mm.
Singapore is obviously tropical and has had the most amount of cases for a tropical one.
Yep.
But it hasn't seen the same levels of outbreaks we've seen in Japan and South Korea and others. So
plus it's a transit hub, so I guess it's probably at a high risk sort of area of anyway.
Picking up people on the way through. Yeah, quite possibly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think there's... it's too early to you know, say that's fine, but I think it does factor in, at least into our thinking of saying, well, does this mean that you've got a 2 or 3 month run at this and then you probably get a bit of a respite in the Northern Hemisphere while the Southern Hemisphere gets it. But in reality is there's not too many countries in the Southern Hemisphere with significant populations.
Yep.
And then the history has been of these ones, unless you've actually come up with a vaccine within the interim, then it probably will come back for the next version.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Oh, interesting. Okay, just quick comparison with SARS.
Yep, flip to David.
Hand over to David.
Yeah, so this was the initial modelling that we started using, what, a month ago, I guess, just to try and encapsulate the economic impact. Basically, you know, it was a very short, sharp shock. All of the sectors you would expect were hit, you know, tourism, transport, retail, passenger traffic, et cetera, et cetera. And they fell very sharply, but it was contained very quickly. And there was this V-shaped recovery that markets have been trading on for the last few weeks. So that's really the only message you need to take out of that, if you want to.
And we've pretty much thrown away, the other message is we've pretty much thrown away this model, though, because it's so much bigger and so much more.
I was going to get to that with the next few charts. Okay. And this, more of the same, SARS, you know, short and sharp. You know, big stimulus, quick rebound, and, you know, everything's more or less okay. So that was the model we started with and we threw away pretty quickly because it looked to us very quickly that it was far more contagious than SARS and was going to spread a lot more widely. So the shutdown was going to have to be more severe. So that's a little bit of potted history and we'll move on to where we are now.
Well, plus as well on the SARS front, China is 4 times bigger now than what it was. Just in terms of size, it only just entered the World Trade Organization, and so you didn't have the supply chain links.
Yep,
like the purchases you had were quite small, and so it was just not the same. We're not talking about the same thing.
Mm. Okay.
So, Damo, we've got the capital economics charts in here.
They're coming after.
After this one.
After this, this is our.
I will keep going. I'll quickly run through those, and then we can come back to that.
Yeah.
Bear with
me. Keep going. Oh, hang on. What's this? This is the wrong doc. Okay. All right. Well, so if you look at a range of real-time charts for China right now, in comparison to that SARS model, it just gets completely blown up. the current quarter in China is going to be negative growth. The next one's going to struggle to rebound. We've got things like, you know, transport and the people movement, traffic and railways, buses, just about everything are still very much stalled. There has been a little bit of a rebound, but very stalled. Same goes for things like coal consumption. And perhaps most importantly of all, if you look at the broader movement of people and migrants across the, you know, sort of coast to coast, border to border in China, you can see that a lot of the migrant workers, the kind of 300 million or so that go home during the Lunar New Year, a lot of them just simply haven't come back. And so as you would expect, if you put yourself in their circumstances, we suspect a lot of them have gone home to families and the families have simply said, well, you can just hang out here until, you know, we get a much... you know, better notion that the entire epidemic has passed. And so this has led to enormous labour shortages right across China. And obviously the implication of that is output is severely restricted. And so, you know, our base case for that is for it to continue far longer than it did with SARS and for the rebound to be slow and halting, because you'll probably get a few more outbreaks of the virus as it tries to reopen. And more importantly, the process of reassuring the Chinese people that they're not going to catch this virus the moment they go back to work is going to take time. So those migrant workers, the government has tried various things already to get them back to work, and some of it's clearly working. There is a bit of an uptick in activity, but it's going to take a long time. It's been a big virus, enough dead for everyone to be pretty upset and angry about it.
Yep.
And so, you know,
when you say increase in activity, what are you talking about there? What are the metrics?
Look, we're starting to see more traffic congestion and whatever, and you know, in the major cities.
Yep.
Things like
so we're basically trying to run this off fast moving data that we can actually see what's happening, because the GDP data, we're not going to see that for another month or two. Well, another month and a half out of China, another two or three months.
Real time property sales, that kind of thing, coal power output, or consumption of coal, all of these things are sort of just slowly trending up, but you know. We're talking from a very low base. Mm. So basically, you know, this quarter is a write-off. Next quarter is going to be pretty close to a write-off.
Yep.
We think it'll obviously be better, but it'll still be severely inhibited. And maybe by Q3, we'll start to get something sort of back to normal China. But at the rate that it's going global... we're going to see a whole sort of second round of impacts globally that are going to come back and rebound on China as well, you know, through its external sector. And so no V-shaped recovery is what you want to take out of it.
Yeah. And the other part is, look, we'd already been speaking quite a bit about how we were seeing companies pull their supply chains out of China already on the back of trade wars and intellectual property and all these other issues that we had before. This is just accelerating the whole issue. This has just brought it right to the front of everyone's focus, is saying, do I really want to base my whole country's future on whether I have my Chinese factories working or not?
Mm, yeah,
absolutely. Or do I actually want to diversify?
Well, that's the longer term takeout, most definitely. Mm. Over the last decade or so, China went from being, you know, more of a niche supply chain player to actually... you know, kind of importing entire supply chains for different industries.
Yep.
And that is no longer viable from a risk management perspective. So there'll be a lot of deglobalization for China ahead.
Yep. Very good.
This next chart is sort of getting into the trade-off between these saving lives and the economic impact.
You spoke a little bit about this on the business last night, Damien.
A little bit, yeah. So what I'm trying to highlight here, then, this is actually from the Spanish flu in sort of 1918.
I'll just say that basically this is our new working model for how this will transpire, since we've thrown out SARS and the research has thrown up, you know, some experiences from the 1980 Spanish flu.
Yep.
And this is a very good one, we think, to run with.
Yeah. So the first line there shows Philadelphia, which sort of basically said, no, everything's fine, guys. Don't worry about this. You know, kept everything. They started getting the first cases. They kept everything open for 3 weeks. And you can just see the amount of people who died was dramatically different to the dotted line, which is St. Louis, where they actually banned public gatherings. Within 2 days of their first couple of cases, they were out banning public gatherings and slowing everything down and stopping the, I think Philadelphia actually had a parade sort of halfway through that, not halfway through, but sort of, I think maybe just before it took off, they had this big city parade with tens of thousands of people all, you know, marching the streets and
stuff
like that.
Kind of like an Olympics, perhaps.
Exactly, yes. Which then probably pushed that even further. So, and our thoughts are that, this is probably not a bad model for seeing what's happening in China.
Yep.
If you took Wuhan and the Hubei province to be that Philadelphia, where you just get this huge blowout in the number of people dying, but it actually finishes relatively quickly. So within sort of 4 to 6 weeks, you've over that most of the hump and you've seen most of the worst of it.
Yep.
Whereas when you slow things down, you actually give your hospitals time to actually treat people. Far fewer people die, but it does mean that it lasts longer.
Yep.
And so, and this sort of lasted into, in St. Louis, sort of lasted into their summer. That's into their winter. That's coming out of the... So they got it, sorry, at the...
through spring.
Throughout their... throughout autumn.
Yeah. Autumn. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. Very good.
Autumn into winter.
Yeah.
Winter. Okay.
But yeah. So that was. But I guess the story is, if you slow it down, it is very, very good for your people. Fewer of them die.
Mm.
But it does mean that the disease lasts longer within your, because you're basically reaching the view that there are so many people who have it now, I can't stop it, but I can slow it down.
Slow the transmission
down. And if I can slow the transmission down, far fewer people will die because my hospital's going to handle it.
Yep.
probably fewer people will get it as well. And I can get it down to the level where it can actually sort of, the disease can either go through, it's either been through the people who are going to catch it or, you know, I can prevent, you know, some, at least some of them. But with a lot of these, you just cannot prevent, you know, certain number of cases. I think as some virologists have explained, is, you know, if we could prevent the flu, we would.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course. So, yeah, absolutely.
There's one point to make about this chart as well in terms of China is, if you accept that the spike is Wuhan and the rest of China is St. Louis, like Philadelphia is Wuhan,
yep.
Then you have to ask yourself why the rest of China has no more cases.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, because according to the experience in the Spanish flu, if they're taking the St. Louis path, they should have it longer.
Yep. Should be more appearing. Yeah, but just fewer numbers eventually. Okay. So the trade-off, I guess, between saving lives and economic impact.
Exactly. So that's exactly the thing every government now around the world has to work out is you put on quarantines, flight bans, you know, you stop everyone from coming in, you will save more lives. Mm. You let as much economic activity go. You know, but that will affect your economy. Yep. You're going to lose out on that front. And so I guess our rough thing is saying, well, somewhere between 0.5% and 1% of people who catch it will probably die. If you put all the quarantines on and slow things down, if you don't, you're probably talking about 5%, but your economy will look much better until it finally hits.
Yep.
So, and possibly come out faster as well at the other side. So, you know, it's a decision every government's going to have to make. Mm. And our expectation is that governments will opt to save lives and to slow the economy down. And that will be the
sort
nature.
That out later. Yeah. And still be electable.
And rightly so.
Yeah, of course.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's far easier to explain why, you know, growth was slower and not as many people have jobs than why so many people died.
Yep, absolutely.
Except perhaps Scott Morrison, but we'll see.
Yeah, let's hope. But and it's interesting, I was just saying from overnight, you know, Donald Trump's really tied his, hoisted his flag on the back of, you know, we're doing a great job and look, we haven't got any cases, which I sort of feel as if...
is he painting himself into a corner a little bit?
Well, it's with an election coming up, it's not a good thing to do. I mean, he's already got problems in his own... so many people have been fired or quit from his administration. You know, the allegations of you're running a shambolic government is already out there.
Yep.
If there is a big outbreak in the US and you've already tied your thing to I'm running the best government ever, and people turn around and go, well, look at all these factors why you were stuffing it up and why all these people were in and out, you know, he's vulnerable.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so...
To a point, though, is he ever really vulnerable to anything? Like... Facts ever gotten in the way of, you know, young Don?
No, but if my grandmother died,
yeah,
that's true. You know, yeah. And
especially then, if it rips through the Poor South or something like that.
Yeah, and the interesting part with the US now, I haven't checked the updated data from today, but as of 2 days ago, they'd run about 430 tests across the entire of America.
Wow!
So
they've Australia got sort of, alone has conducted 3,000.
Yeah, and South Korea is talking about numbers in the hundreds of thousands as they're trying to work out where it's going. They've got these really big goals as to how they're going to do it. So.
That could be because a test in the US costs $1,000 and it's like free over here, though, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe. But they actually sent out the wrong test kits to a bunch of places and they had to withdraw all the test kits.
Wow.
And they're even still, they're talking about a couple of weeks before they'll get proper test kits out to people. So it hasn't been run well at all in the US. And so vulnerability for Trump. But it's also the point about saying they've got way more students than anyone else. There's sort of 350,000 odd students in... Chinese students in the US.
And they haven't had travel bans, or they have?
They have had travel bans, but they put them on the same time. They put them on at the in the start of... I had them on that chart. At the start of February.
Okay.
So there was enough time, though, for... I mean, every other country's had enough time to get people in before that.
Yep.
You'd have to think there's at least a few there. And so the issue... US hasn't reported a lot, but is that because... there is something different about the US or the whatever, or is it just because they're just not running tests? If you've only run 400 tests, there's a limited number you're going to find.
Yep.
You're not going to have hundreds.
That's the reason. So, don't ask, don't tell.
So the danger is in the US, I mean, it might be fine, but the danger in the US is maybe there is already an outbreak, we just don't know about it. So, and it's a bit like Italy. Like, I mean, Italy is a first world country, pretty good medical systems and all that.
Yep.
It was definitely in Italy for weeks before Until the death started to happen and people were like, let's go and check them. Wow, this person has coronavirus. Let's go check all his mates. Yep. Wow, they've also got it. Let's actually start branching out and finding out. All of a sudden, we've got hundreds of cases.
And the US is in winter at the moment as well. So,
yes,
in
winter.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, very good. The cycle. So, looking from an economic standpoint.
Yeah. Now, this one, this to me is the key for, and this is where we started, part of the reason why we pulled back our holdings, even before we'd seen a broad spread. We sort of went, well, if a pandemic happens, at the start, we were sort of like, this has all the hallmarks of a pandemic, but could easily go the other way. So let's, we're not sort of investing on the basis of predicting a pandemic, at the start of it, but we were sort of tracking and saying it has all the hallmarks of a pandemic. And so we really do need to watch it carefully.
Yep.
The thing that got us though was saying, you go through these debt cycles, and I've got a chart up here, which is the corporate debt to GDP in the US. And it basically, for anyone just listening, not watching, it basically starts at sort of the high 30% of GDP and goes up to into the 40s. And then you have this peak and you have a recession. And which comes first is the corporate debt. So usually the corporate debt cycle is sort of helping to start the recession.
Yep.
And then it comes flying back down to almost as low as it was before. And then it rises again. And so every time we hit this credit cycle peaks and then it starts falling, we're into recession.
Yep.
And we know this is one of the longest economic expansions we've ever seen. We know corporate debt is actually now at record highs.
Yep.
And we know something is going to knock this off at some stage. And we were positing that, whether it doesn't have to be a global pandemic, it can just be this disruption of the supply chains and the disruption of demand coming from Chinese tourists that can knock this off the
all these high leveraged companies that are moments away from bankruptcy if they don't
exactly
produce.
And so and these people who have got these high levels of debt and now they're sort of and yes, fine, I've got all my products, but I've actually got a 6-week air gap now because they haven't been producing in China. And so maybe they've started now, but by the time I put it on the boat, I've got to wait 6 weeks before it comes off the boat. They're the ones we're worried about. And
indeed, the market is now worried about them.
Yes.
Like the last 3 days, there's been virtually zero high-grade bond issuance in the US and Europe.
So what that's saying is the high bond, the bond market is freezing up.
Yep.
And the same way as what we saw in the financial crisis, it was back to consumer loans. And it was sort of a different type of debt. I mean, there's still corporate debt had issues, as you can see on this graph. But it was mainly the consumer debt that was where it all started. And that sort of started to freeze up, which was what caused everything to roll over. What we're saying is this is, we're not saying it's absolutely going to happen. And you have to, it's a guaranteed.
Yep.
But there's a very strong chance of it. Markets are expensive.
They're looking for a reason.
We're looking for a reason.
Yep.
Yeah.
We felt we may as well sit on the sideline and wait and see. And we're still not, as we said, corporate debt markets are freezing up.
Yep.
We're certainly not rushing back in and saying, markets are down 5%. We've got to get in and buy before we, because if this thing rolls over, then this is the start of the next recession. And it's not something central banks are going to be able to save by turning the printing presses on. And they've already, none of them have any more ammunition.
There is another parallel with the GFC in that the nature of the risk, it's not precisely the same, but it's kind of analogous in that, and central banks can't necessarily do much about it in that it's just, in the GFC you had counterparty risk run through the entire financial system in such a way that nobody knew who was vulnerable.
Yep.
And so nobody would trade anything. And analogously, it's the same because nobody understands the virus. Nobody understands who's vulnerable.
Yep.
Or the supply chains.
Yep. Or the supply chains. And there's all these companies coming out and just saying, we can't give guidance. If you can tell me what's going to happen with the virus, then I'll tell you my guidance.
Yeah, sure.
And so a central bank can't really fix that. It's another form of counterparty risk.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, we're going to see the higher risk ends of the bond market melt down pretty soon. I think, and yields start to rise.
And the danger there is that what happens is the good companies now, they're usually not good companies at this end, but there are companies out there that will be thrown out that would have otherwise been fine.
Yeah.
Because they'll be the ones who are, they've got this debt expiring, they've got to roll it over, they're paying back what debt to one person and rolling it over to the next set. It's not like a home loan in consumer parlance, it's like having your home loan every 3 or 4 years. You actually have to go and give all the money back and then go and borrow the money from somebody else.
Yeah.
And so for these companies, they're giving all the money back and then going to borrow and
no one there.
They're just saying, no, that's fine. And they're like, look, everything's fine.
Yeah.
They're like, well, yeah, but we don't know what your supply chain's like. And
yeah.
And the issue with these supply chains is there's some of these things have, you know, especially the manufacturers, they might have thousands of parts. And you only need a few of those parts to be coming from China and to be locked
that's
up
right.
and
can't sell the car.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
So So it's a big issue, and we're far from past.
Yep. Yeah.
Far from into safety.
All right. Scary stuff. All right. So cumulative real returns.
Yeah.
The wall
actually,
of worry.
This was a comment we were making before, saying, look, markets do generally go up. You generally yep. do, you know, there's a stock trade in turning up on you know, whenever these things happen, and just saying, hey, calm down, everyone. These things happen. This is buy the dip opportunity. Everything will be fine. You know, markets generally go up, and they're right. You will recover, but you do go through periods where you know, it took 10 years to recover from the.
You've got to be singing that song for a long time.
Exactly. You can go through very long periods before you get your money back, and we think this. We're not absolutely positive this is one of those cases, but yep. we know that markets are expensive, and we know there's enough risks there that we think you should just be sitting on the sideline and say, look, let's just wait. If yep. I miss out on the chances on a little bit of a bounce, that's fine, because the downside risk at the moment is much higher than the potential for upside.
Got to weigh the evidence, haven't you, and then act appropriately.
And the other thing I'd say as well, we've only got equities, debt, and bank deposits here. I would say you want liquid assets right now.
Mm.
You do not want to be owning corporate bonds and other factors that other types of unlisted assets that just don't sell very often because
can lock up. Yeah.
Exactly. You the chance of you getting locked up into that fund if things do get worse
yep.
is high.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one that fits into that category is a house. If you own a house, that is an illiquid asset. You cannot turn around tomorrow and sell it.
Yep.
You can turn around and sell it, but you cannot turn around and get money for it tomorrow.
Mm.
You know, even if you do sell it, you might have to sell it again in a few months' time when the person doesn't come through, and you know, there's all those other factors. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Right now, our expectation, certainly within our portfolios, everything we're doing is liquid assets, because if you do want to switch back or you do get some sudden massive huge stimulus, then
yep.
You can switch back in. But if you're holding these illiquid assets, you're stuck. What
yep.
you own is what you own.
Yeah, fantastic point, Dave. Excellent. Okay, the Australian fallout. Who'd like to begin, David?
Yeah, so, you know, this is pretty much an old story now, but tourism and students is the pointy end of it. We don't make much anymore these days, so we're not really in the supply chain hit. More in the services end, and so this damage is unfolding really before our eyes. The student damage is already done. We saw Flight Centre out today with an immense profit warning.
Mm-hmm.
Its guidance was kind of amusing. It said, you know, after SARS there was a V-shaped recovery, so we'll be fine in the second half, but anyway, we'll see on that. So tourism has been belted. The students don't have to be here yet. Their final deadline is approaching in the next week or two.
Mm.
But clearly, a lot of them would already be here if it weren't for the travel ban. The government keeps torturing our elderly with teasers of whether they're going to drop that ban and bring the students in.
Mm. I just want to holler as well. It's macabre that we've got a government who's talking about relaxing, just as every other country's
tightening up
and yep. saying, just a minute, we don't know where this is all coming from. Let's tighten up our borders. And we're talking about saying, which we actually did move quite quickly, way faster than what I thought.
Yep.
So there was actually a very good move in terms of that whole, let's lock down the travel and just do the quarantine.
Look, I don't know what's going on with it. I honestly think it's political suicide, which, you know, politicians aren't renowned for. But the Australian universities have been lobbying very hard and have reached levels of irresponsibility that are kind of difficult to fathom for public institutions.
They're going to need bailouts.
Well, I was going to say, they're gambling with their own solvency, though, really, aren't they?
Well, they'll need bailouts. Give them the bailouts. Mm. You know, and, you know, the government, on the other hand, is busy saying we don't have any money to give anyone.
Mm.
Like, they've got it completely backwards. You shut the border and you open the fiscal pipe.
Yep.
You know, and of course they can afford it. You know, in this age of QE, you can afford pretty much anything.
But even without QE, we've got one of the least geared governments in the
world.
Yes,
we do. Yeah. And they're obsessed with the surplus, etc. And it all comes back to supporting banks and house prices and what have you. But
And it's not like universities aren't profitable or anything. I'm pretty sure if you lent them a block of dough, you'll get it back at some point. So.
Yeah, look, it's fine. You know, that's what should happen. If it doesn't happen, I think that the government is literally committing suicide. Mm. I mean, all you'll have to do at the next election is whisper bushfires and virus, and everyone will pull out a revolver.
Yeah, say that for the next couple of decades.
Yeah, exactly. If you end up unleashing the virus through in a quick way, in going back to our Philadelphia versus St. Louis model, and you make Australia Philadelphia with 5% mortality rate when it could have been 1. I mean. I don't know where to even look, to be honest. So anyway, we've got the students hit. It'll probably continue. Let's assume they're sane enough. Even if the students come in, I don't think it matters a great deal because, you know, obviously as this thing gets worse and worse, I think the consumer will bunker some more. It's already, you know, she's already very, very cautious. I think that's likely to intensify. And we've also got, you know, data out now that suggests we might have been already in recession in Q4 last year. We're certainly going to be in recession in Q1. So there's going to be a lot of negative data flow. You know, we're going to get an unemployment spike of some magnitude.
Yep.
And so, you know, all of those things will have kind of self-fulfilling or self-feeding dynamics. And then, you know, going out probably into Q2, we're into probably, I think, a bulk commodity price hit. They've all held up so far, largely, I think, because logistics have been so heavily disrupted in China. So it's been difficult to get iron ore and coking coal and thermal coal into China. So the Mongolian border shut, for instance, which meant that a lot of the more local production of these commodities was unavailable. Mm-hmm. And so we've had a bit of a bid in them for the last few weeks. But if, you know...
And as well, there's been this whole... there's been very much a market narrative is that central banks are going to come out, and particularly the Chinese central bank is going to come out, the biggest stimulus package you've ever seen.
That's part of it.
And, they're going to build.
So, but
there's
at the same time...
There's a lot of lag in that as well, though, isn't there? There's a lot of lag in that as well, though. Like, you're really looking over
some lag, but, you know... While the commodities have not been terribly available, the steel mills have never shut down. They've been running out steel like crazy, and the end user demand has collapsed, of course, because the economy's basically stalled.
Sitting at home,
and so there are these immense piles of steel inventories just everywhere. They're record highs across the board, still growing, and so the steel mills are going to have to ratchet back their output, and you know, that's going to start hitting these bulk commodity prices. So that comes in and lands on the budget and national income and all the rest. The sort of risk case nightmare scenario is that, look, the likelihood is the virus is going to come here, because really you can't shut everybody out in the end. You can slow it down, but it'll probably get here. And if it is winter based as it appears to be, it's going to arrive into our autumn winter. And we may have all of these most severe effects in our economy at the same time that the virus actually outbreaks here or breaks out here, and, you know, the government's forced into some of the draconian measures that we're seeing elsewhere, depending on how severe any outbreak was, of course. But you can imagine if they do let some students in and you get a little bit of a dozen kids, not much more, at one campus.
Yep.
The entire system shuts down.
Yep.
This is the craziness of doing it in the first place.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, in effect, you've got a very weak economy hit by a very nasty shock. A government that's refusing to mitigate that shock in both fiscally and physically. And so this all comes back to the RBA. Like, everybody thinks they're going to cut in April. I can't see why they wouldn't cut next week. All of this is as plain as day.
And if debt markets stay frozen, we're almost positive they will.
Yeah.
If debt markets stay frozen, we're almost positive the RBA will cut.
Yeah.
Sorry, we're not.
This is a very fast-moving feast, right? So, as Damo says, if we don't see any new bond issuance in global markets over the next 4 or 5 days, the RBA will cart.
Mm. Not even 4 or 5, we've got three days.
Yeah, well, yeah. Whatever it is. I mean, there has to be a high risk that the RBA works this out. You know, it's not a risk anymore, yeah. Right? This is a real shock.
Yep.
And so they need to get to QE as quickly as they can, is my view on this, because the way that these risks are kind of piling one atop the other, we could very easily see, you know, credit market freeze lifting interest rates for the banks really fast. Mm. And they need to be able to offset that. You know, the government guarantee is going to be useless.
Yep.
They need to be able to offset any kind of funding shock for the banks with QE quickly.
Yep.
So I don't know whether they'll cut. I mean, I don't know, but there's a very strong case for it in my view. If they don't, then they'll be maybe forced to go mid meeting, and they're certainly going to go in April. That's a certainty.
Yep.
And I would suggest if they do, they'd be going straight again in May and then QE in the second half. Yep. I mean, like, there's just rolling shocks through this.
Great time for term deposit holders, anyway.
Yeah. Well, they're not front of mind right now.
No. And speaking of investments, so investment implications. We've got a laundry list here of corporate debt market, consumers, companies, central banks and governments. So what are the reactions we're predicting here?
Look, I just wanted to point out that what the biggest uncertainty is what they call reflexivity, is saying just because you think something's going to happen, so you don't know what the next step is.
Yep.
And what other people's reactions are. And so the five big things we really don't know how they're going to react is this corporate debt market. Will it stay frozen and locked up? And we think certainly rates are going to jump significantly, and there's going to be significantly less lending in that. And it's quite possible that this could be our end of cycle event, the corporate debt market. So that's the key one we're watching.
Sure.
Yep. Consumers is the next one. So our take is that if you haven't really been affected in an economy, so say like Australia, then consumers are pretty fine. Yeah, if it passed and Australia have got it, then they're off and running again.
Yep.
At the point where they're starting to get locked down and quarantined, I think that's the point where consumers are going to be sitting on their hands. So I think in China is a good example of that. I think your first step after you've been locked up in your apartment for 3 weeks is not to rush out and buy a new car and a new Louis Vuitton handbag.
No, that's right.
I think there's more, people will be a lot more cautious in terms of what they're doing, and just that whole sense of slowing down. That's going through other countries now, South Korea, potentially Japan is getting close to that point as well. They haven't started any lockdowns yet, but Japan could be easily there. Italy is there. So we do think there's going to be a flow through from consumers.
And there's just a note on that as well. You're sort of reading more and more about how people are having their pays frozen, using up leave. Those sort of things sound like it's sort of becoming a lot more prevalent through China. And I guess that reflecting that back on the fact that most people seem to only be able to survive maybe 1 to 2 months with available cash flow, an income. Mm. If you're held up in home, then obviously you're probably not going to be spending much if your income's been suspended. Casual workers, for example, if you're getting a quarantine situation.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, you'll definitely be saving more in the future, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Absolutely.
Companies, the whole supply chain, there's a lot going on with that, and it's day to day. I think one of the things I want to highlight with the companies is it's interesting for me to see how good the companies are at what's going on in their supply chain. So there's some people who come out quite early in terms of we've got problems, and there's other ones that as time goes on they're like, oh, actually we do have a problem with that. And so and you don't know what the second order effects are. Like your supplier might be based in Australia and his supplier is based in Australia, but that guy's supplier is based in China. And so there's all these second and third order effects that companies just don't know about. And given a boat from China takes 3 weeks or longer to most countries, and the US even a bit longer again.
Yep.
The effects of shutdowns are really only just starting to be felt, and as companies are running out. So we saw in Korea, for example, a little while ago, Hyundai shut down its production because it didn't have the parts it needed to do it. And so that's where what's happening in companies will make a big difference, and what they're doing with the debt. Central banks is the next one. Actually, I'll pump that one to you, David. You haven't said anything for a while. Give me a chance to break.
They're all going to ease, aren't they?
And the question about how quickly and will they be on the front foot, and is it enough, and do they buy corporate debt? Some of these guys.
Oh yes, of course. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, if it gets bad, obviously, if the credit market freeze continues, you know, one of the key lessons you will get from the GFC is that central banks, you know, will innovate. And start to do, you know, whatever it takes. So there are obviously various central banks around the world that are already buying corporate debt, and so we could see that kind of thing spread.
Will they buy a high risk corporate debt? That's the one where that's where you really get some moral hazard.
You got to draw the line somewhere.
You'd like to think so.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the thing is, when it's a virus like this, everybody can put their hand up and say, "Look, we're a victim here."
Yeah.
You know, this is Mother Nature. We didn't do anything wrong. Mm. And so the claim on support is sort of morally a bit stronger than if you're over-leveraged and, you know, just got the cycle wrong.
Yeah.
That said, risk has been massively mispriced into this accident. So that as you pointed out in your corporate debt chart, that excuse only washes so much. Something already always disrupts it.
Yeah, and so Hong Kong
government's guaranteed
$2 million.
Yeah, so that'd be high risk corporate bonds.
That's all small businesses mainly. So which are higher risk, but yeah, small businesses.
So what's this like? So like an emergency liquidity thing they put out for small businesses?
Basically, yes.
Yeah, right. Interesting.
So you're going to see a lot more of that.
And they're giving $10,000 to every Hong Kong citizen.
Oh wow.
$10,000 Hong Kong dollars.
Okay.
So yeah. But I think they'll probably issue that as government debt. I don't think that's helicopter money yet. But yeah, we might see some helicopter money. Who knows?
Yeah, absolutely.
But yes, we're going to see central bank innovation, no doubt. And sensible governments will be spending aggressively.
Yep.
Through this, alas, we don't have one of them, but they will be. As mentioned, though, the question becomes, you know, can they make a difference? Certainly governments can with a big fiscal push. Central banks, the reason we had such mispriced risk was the central banks were so aggressive already. And as we've already discussed, you know, the virus impact on business is such that it's kind of a bit like counterparty risk for which central banks really can't do anything. Mm. You know, you've got to restore trust somehow rather than just liquidity.
Yep.
Because you're facing all these potential insolvencies.
Yep.
So they can support, but I'm not sure they can cure it in much the same way as, you know, transpired in the GFC.
Mm. And I think you need government anyway to start, when they start guaranteeing loans. And so we saw in the US...
Look, we'll see a lot of that, I think.
Yeah, we saw in the US with the big car makers, they stepped in and you know, took over the loans and because they just wouldn't be able to write
everything. Underwrote
everything.
Yeah. Yep.
So, and effectively the Aussie banks as well, underwrote the Aussie banks. Yep. That's the type of thing which is not really central banks, so it ends up back in the government.
Mm.
And the governments don't tend to be that fast to do these things, and as we saw again in the financial crisis, you know, that the initial round went to and got knocked back, and then the stock market fell, I can't remember, 10%, 15%, it fell a huge amount the next day, and then they sent it back and they got signed the next day type thing. So there is some of these where governments will they're not going to be the... Whereas a central bank might go, there's a shutdown in this area, I really need to pump liquidity in there, we're deciding today and we're doing it this afternoon.
Yep.
Governments tend to really have to be pushed and dragged, and you know, they need to set up all the legislation, and then we need to convince everyone, and you know, it's not a fast... And the type of spending as well is not, tomorrow we're rushing out and building all this extra stuff. It's like, well, tomorrow we'll set out some RFPs and you know, within a few months we'll get them all back and we'll
green field spec it out. We'll go to tender.
Exactly. Yep. So they're not the types of quick spends, unless you are actually doing cash flash type things, which we've seen the Hong Kong government already do.
Yep.
It's probably worth mentioning as well that it's a different world than it was in 2007. Like, it's much more adversarial. You're not going to have a kind of a happy clappy G20 meeting where everyone commits to spending 1 or 2% of GDP fiscally. Mm. You know, they'll come together and you know, put a gun to each other's heads, probably.
Well, but even so, within countries though as well, you're going to have people go. I mean, it seems there's certainly parties who are not in power who are more than willing to say, let the party in power take a big economic thing and say, no, this is so perfidious, and you know, we can't afford it, and you know, it's all these things like that just to drive the economy down so they can get voted in next time because everyone hates the
it's a much more fractured world, so you're going to get more fractured support.
Yeah, well, and I was going to say, that being said, that party's currently in at the moment, so I suppose they're probably going to have to spend. Anyway, we're better, in the interest of time, we'll just quickly roll through the final one and the most important part, so investment implications.
Yes.
How are we using these themes, Damien, in our investment portfolio?
This is what we put up the first time. Bonds bid, Aussie dollar down, commodities down, stocks down. That was our list of four things.
Four for four.
And so, yeah, so as at the last time we ran this, we had 3 out of 4 and the stocks had been holding up and the others had done. And so now they've come through. Despite that, it's not, we're not calling a victory. And I think we think there's still more to run. And the risks are still, the risks are growing.
Yep.
They're not shrinking. Like this virus has doubled every 5 days for outside of China. Transmission outside of China has doubled every 5 days for the last month.
Yep.
And it's still doubling. And so until we actually see that start to slow down.
Caution.
And yep. Now we're seeing the debt market freeze up. You know, if that doesn't get unclogged, if we don't see central banks and governments starting to step in, then there's more downside risk.
Yep.
When we do, we'll have to be assessing, you know, is this big enough to turn this around or not? And the past experience has been, they don't go big enough at the start.
Yep.
And then things get worse, and then they decide to go big enough.
Yep.
And so, yeah, we just really do need to judge this on a day by day basis. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, the the thing that's triggering it all can just keep growing.
Mm.
Mm. You know, I mean, if it were a financial contagion of some sort, then an entree of the central bank could make a very big difference. Mm. If it's not a sort of epochal shock or big end of cycle event. But when the virus can just, you know, the Fed comes out and says we're going to cut and the market rallies and then the virus doubles over the next 4 days and everyone's like, well, so what?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So we switched a lot of our stuff, you know, a month ago. Some of the bigger names we hold, things like Gilead, which is sort of one of the names out there trying to develop a vaccine for it. And actually, just to say on those vaccines, there's no miracle cure coming. Like, there will likely be vaccines. There's enough human intellectual capital pushed at this now. There will likely be vaccines. And they'll be pushed out much faster than you expect, but you're talking months before you get there. Because, as I was saying last night, you know, we've got this problem in the world of these anti-vaxxers out there who won't take vaccinations for diseases that have been around for decades.
Yep.
And we want to come up with a cure for this and rush it out within the next 20 minutes and give it to the whole population.
And assume that they're going to accept it.
If you get it wrong, you've just lost, you've lost faith in that whole system and your measles and all these. Like, you've just grown the anti-vaxxers ranks by exponentially. So they do need to do this properly, and they do need to make sure they've done the proper tests and all that type of stuff to get it through.
Yep.
But those types of names, those... The consumer staples, you know, we cleared out of all our oil stocks and travel stocks and all those types of ones. Names like Essity, which is one of the probably has some supply chain issues, but they're one of the biggest, world's biggest manufacturers of hygienic products and all your hand sanitizers and all your stuff that goes into hospitals. Clorox, which is a huge US of disinfectants and huge US manufacturer and seller of disinfectants. And it's those types of companies where we're saying, okay, we think there's a little bit of safety in those and certainly defensiveness right across the board.
Yep.
What we're really trying to do within the stocks ourselves at the moment, so we sold out heaps. Actually, our next chart's got
our current settings for the various portfolios there for the data box.
So we're basically 50% ish underweight. Actually, that's not the updated chart either. You've got the old one in there.
Oh.
Anyway, skip that one.
Okay.
We're about 50% underweight the equities. We'll put the right one up in the show notes.
Yeah, sure.
But we're basically 50% underweight equities in our growth portfolios. Our growth portfolio is actually up over the last month so far. So equity markets are down 5-6% from their peaks. our portfolio so far are up just because we have taken that sort of defensive nature and tried to be in the bonds and international currencies. And so we sort of feel that's been relatively, we've certainly been happy with that position so far. But going forward, what we're more interested in is sort of pretty much holding that position and trading up in value in our stock portfolio. So as these things happen, you will see stocks smashed much lower.
Yep.
As they come out and do their profit warnings, and it's a relative bet between now saying, you know, here's stock A, which produces same good as stock B. Stock A just came out with a profit warning and got smashed. We own stock B. Okay, we don't think there's a lot of difference between the two. Maybe we sell B and buy A.
Yep.
Just to sort of keep trading up the quality or the value within our portfolio over this time frame. But you know, we're very much in terms of the actual overall, you know, we're certainly not looking to buy yet.
Yep.
We sort of feel there's still enough risks around that your discretion is the better part of valor.
Okay, very good. Well, on that note, thanks gentlemen for an important update on a huge crisis, probably the biggest thing hopefully for 2020, and we'll look forward to the next one. Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.